Happy New Year, everybody! Welcome to 2012. You're listening to The Circle Day on Resonance 104.4 FM. On today's show, we have Derek Jensen and Franklin Lopez. It's a half an hour show, but to catch the full version of it, go to www.thecircleday.com. Derek Jensen is the acclaimed author of 20 books, including A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Belief and Endgame. His writing has been described as breaking and mending the reader's hearts. He holds a degree in creative writing from Eastern Washington University, a degree in mineral engineering physics from the Colorado School of Mines, and has taught at Eastern Washington University and Pelican Bay State Prison. He has packed university auditoriums, conferences and bookstores across the nation, stirring them with revolutionary spirit. Franklin Lopez, who is a filmmaker, is also with us, who made Ensiv, which was an adaptation of Jensen's Endgame. He runs Submedia TV, an online platform for activists' video, mashup and documentary. Okay, first question. I recently watched the Ensiv documentary, which introduced me to many new ideas on the collapse of capitalism, of the capitalism system, and really blew my mind away with its powerful arguments. The film is based on Endgames, Volume 1 and 2. Could you tell us what motivated you to write these books?
I'd be happy to. Before I do that, though, I want to say that actually, honestly, I think Ensiv is way more than an adaptation of Endgame. I think that that Frank has brought his own creative genius to this and made it something much more. In any case, Endgame came about for a couple reasons. One of them is that I would ask people all over the country, do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And nobody ever says yes. And then the next question is, if you don't believe the culture is going to undergo voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics if you care about life on this planet? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. One of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all busy waiting for this magical transformation that we know is not going to happen. And so this book was really about that shift in strategy and tactics, that if you're not waiting for, If you're sick of begging for the capitalist in chief to do something that's not going to serve the ends of capital, then what are you going to do? And so it's partly about that. And then another of the parts of the genesis of this book is that in A Language Older Than Words, I talked about how the culture is really psychologically irredeemable, how I think people are, this culture traumatizes people so much that they end up really sort of deformed and shifted. And then culture make-believe is really about how the culture's system of social rewards leads inevitably to atrocities. But the problem with both of those arguments is that you can argue about psychology and you can argue about sociology, but I wanted to talk about how this culture is irredeemable and unsustainable on the level of resource movement, because you can't argue with that. You can't argue with the notion that that if you have a city, you require a countryside that you can steal from. If you have an empire, you require colonies to steal from. You can't argue with that. And so this book was talking about how this culture is functionally, on the level of resource movement, unsustainable. And so once again, if you care about salmon, if you care about lampreys, if you care about oceans, if you care about forests, if you care about salamanders, newts, if you care about indigenous peoples, then, and if you care about the poor, then what are you going to do to stop this machine? And that's really where the book started.
Great. And likewise to Franklin, what motivated you to make Ensiv? And how did you find this creative process?
I was working in New York City for Democracy Now! And I was really pushing the show to do a segment on the issue of peak oil. They had not to that day done a show about that issue, and it was something that it was an issue that I found that was going to be the most important things in the world at the moment. And I don't know if you have been to, or anybody has been to a peak oil conference, but usually what you expect from those conferences is a bunch of talk about sustainable agriculture, permaculture, solar panels, all kinds of alternative energies, new ways of heating your home that are more energy efficient. But all in all, it's essentially a bunch of white people who are scared to death of what's going to happen when the shit goes down, and they want to build themselves like little bunkers in the countryside and escape the collapse, right? And Derek came in. I had never heard of Derek before that day, and he blew my mind. And he changed the entire tone of the conference, because while the peak oilers were talking about saving their own skin, saving their own butts, Derek was talking about confronting the mechanisms that are destroying nature. And I think that that's where I was at mentally. But again, being like in a post 9/11 world, I think people were scared to even say these things out loud.
Absolutely.
He was Derek in New York City saying these things out loud. So he finished his talk, and I was just like, I'm going to make a movie about whatever this guy is talking about. You know, I picked up his books that day, and I went to the tables to get them signed, and I said, like, I want to make a movie about this. And he said, let's talk. And so that's how the conversation started.
Wow. And then it was creative love at first sight. okay, next question. How does animal and farms on a local scale affect capitalism and mass corruption and all that comes with it?
Okay, so the question is, how do local farms affect capitalism on a mass scale?
Yeah.
Well, I think that relocalizing is a very important part of what we need to do to unhook from the system in the best we can, and to not support the global agro corporations that are causing tremendous harm. But at the same time, I think it's really important to recognize that small farms and patronizing small farms, I mean, not in the best sense, and, you know, buying from small farms will always, within capitalism, remain a niche market and will not be able to cause larger scale social change. Mm. And what I mean by that is that there are reasons that Tyson Foods should be in quotes, really, there are reasons that the big corporations are able to produce food for cheaper. You know, it's economies of scale, subsidies from the government, governments forcing markets open. And the logic of capitalism in that way guarantees that these localized foods will always remain niche markets, because why should I buy, I mean, I can only buy free-range eggs if I've got the money to pay $5 to $8 a dozen versus $1.50 a dozen for the ones that are based on torment. And so it's only if you've got the extra money to burn that you're able to do that, which guarantees that won't be sufficient to actually shut down those the existence of those small farms will never be sufficient to shut down the big agri-corporations. And so what we need to do is, in addition to attempting to support local farms, we also need to work to actively bring down the entire system that makes it so the small farms are not economically competitive. I mean, this is in the United States, this is a huge deal, and has been a huge deal for many, many years. That one of the reasons that people from Mexico one of the reasons they come to the United States is because they can no longer raise corn economically to compete with the big agri-corporation sending corn down from Iowa. And NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, has absolutely destroyed communities in Mexico. Because the United States, the agri-corporations are able to dump their corn for cheap. And this is why so many people around the world really hate U.S., quote, aid, end quote, because it almost always destroys local farm systems. and local food production systems. It's like years ago, I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, the MRTA, rebel group in Peru. And I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? And his response was, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. And that's the entire struggle right there. And so really, I mean, this is going to be the same with many questions that you ask, is that if you ask almost any question, it's going to lead to, we need to destroy the whole system that is harming, in this case, local agriculture.
Yeah, and I agree. Thanks. This one's to Franklin. You recently spent some time in Tokyo on the NCIV tour. What was the reaction to NCIV in one of the biggest and most densely populated cities in the world? How was the message received, and what kind of questions came up in the discussion after the film? In particular, what was the feeling about the use of militant direct action tactics among Japanese activists and organizers? And do you think the nuclear disasters made it easier for the NCIV message to sink in?
I'll start with that one first, because if you would have asked me if I wanted to go to tour with this film in Japan before the nuclear action, I would have said no, because I made this film almost specifically for a North American audience, and mostly a North American wide audience. When I got the invitation to go to Japan post nuclear disaster, I said absolutely yes. I think that people are going to be open to this message, and I was absolutely correct. People absolutely, to say that you love this film is kind of weird, because the film is not super upbeat, but the message was really well received by folks there. I think they understand the insanity of industrial civilization even more now than ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you consider that like a third of Japan is now irradiated, that parts of Tokyo are irradiated, mm-hmm. and that the government is basically covering up and not evacuating people as they should, it basically shows that yes, indeed, the civilization is insane, and I think it's very easy to explain this to people now that this is actually happening. But in terms of a militant action, the history of Japan is really interesting, because there were a lot of militant groups that sprung up during the 70s, but they were also amazingly sectarian, to the point that they were killing each other and also killing people within their own ranks. And so I think this history of the new left in Japan in the 70s left a really bad taste in people's mouth. And so I think that the idea of militancy has to be reframed in Japan to, you know, essentially like disconnect itself from the counterproductive ways in which a lot of the folks in the 70s did them. But also there has to be an understanding that, you know, very much like in Britain, Japan is also very similar in the ways that Japanese society is super controlled and it's super failed, and the penalties in prison are severe, which include a state-sanctioned torture. And so activists there understand that, you know, that this government and that system is not going to just shut down the nuclear power industry, for instance, just because they ask nicely, but they really have to choose when to act so that it'll be worth it. Because in Japan, if you are arrested and if you're if the government decides to prosecute, you are definitely going to jail, because it's 99%. They have a 99% rate of conviction. So people understand that this needs to happen, but their context is an extreme context, and they really have to rebuild that culture of militancy, but with a new context.
Yes. This one is to Derek. Greenwashing is the tool that is used to mislead us into thinking consumption is the salvation out of this mess. Can you explain the flaws in that?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. The 1980s were the first time that the corporate media called human beings consumers more often than it called them citizens. And that's a really important transformation. If those in power can get you to perceive yourself as a consumer rather than as a, to identify as a consumer rather than as a citizen, your range of resistance is much less. As a consumer, basically, I can buy or I cannot buy. That's basically it. Those are my choices as a consumer. As a citizen, I have far more range of resistance. I can buy, I cannot buy, I can boycott, I can organize, I can vote, I cannot vote. And in the United States Declaration of Independence, it says directly, when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right of people to alter or abolish it. Which means as a citizen, it is your right to destroy a destructive institution. That's if you're a citizen, not if you're a consumer. And I would actually go a step further, and I would say it's not merely your right, but and it's not even a responsibility, but instead something more like breathing, something that if you don't do, you die. Because if you don't destroy destructive institutions, they will destroy your community. But there's another transformation I want to talk about too, which comes a few thousand years ago, which is a few thousand years ago, we somehow became transformed from human animals who live in communities and who need habitat into citizens of states. And part of that transformation is the classic deal where you supposedly grant the state a monopoly on violence. And that's a bad deal too, because as human animals who require community and habitat, animals fight back when they're attacked. And they don't wait for, they can certainly be tactical, but they don't defer to institutions that don't serve them well. And so I think the transformation to consumers is part of a huge, part of a movement away from our bodies and away from our communities and giving up additional power. And there's another thing I would like to say about that, a couple things I would like to say about that. One of them is that one of the things that ends up happening if you end up perceiving yourself, if you give up, okay, it's like a friend of mine says that the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to take down those systems of oppressive authority. And one of the things that ends up happening when you define yourself as a consumer is you actually can't make significant change for the reasons we talked about before, about there are no personal solutions to social problems. I can't stop pornography merely by not looking at it. I can't stop rape by merely not raping. I can't stop the oil economy simply by not driving a car. And it's really, and one of the things it does, this is also really crucial, is like if you watch the movie An Inconvenient Truth, what happens is they lay out the problem pretty clearly, that's all great, that's all fine, and then what happens at the end? Instead of talking about corporate control, instead of talking about power, what happens is they turn everything back to solutions that are personal, like inflating tires, changing light bulbs, stuff we all know isn't going to work. And this happens with all these damn movies. I mean, like Food Inc., for example, they do this great job of laying out how the global food production system is just wretched. It causes atrocities. It destroys lives. It's really terrible to non-humans. It's just awful. And then their solution is what? To buy yogurt from fucking Walmart? Are you kidding? And so that's one of the things that happens when you look for personal solutions. They're completely insufficient. They end up actually being really disempowering too. And another thing that happens is the only thing that when you give up on actually making social change through the hard work of organizing, recruiting, and taking on those in power, all you're really left with are these entirely insignificant personal choices that lead you to merely sort of measuring how pure you are. And so I'm more pure than you because I use recycled shampoo, you know, I don't know what. and that's, those choices are all completely insufficient. They don't make any difference. And I mean, I actually live pretty simply myself, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate. You know, this is not a political statement.
Yeah.
And nobody in their right mind would think that, you know, recycling would have stopped Hitler, or that riding bicycles would stop the Nazis, or that we could have stopped apartheid by composting. You know, but suddenly we get really stupid when it's brought to the present day. And so the whole consumer thing, and who does that help anyway? All it really helps is different capitalists. And one more thing about this, and then I'll shut up, is that if you ask any reasonably intelligent 8-year-old, how do you stop global warming caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? I guess two things. They'll tell you, stop burning oil and gas. And if you ask a 35-year-old, they'll probably give you some answer that has to do with buying this fancy high-tech green stuff that helps high-tech firms. And the other way to look at this that I think makes it pretty clear is if space aliens had come down and they'd invaded this planet and they were vacuuming the oceans, you know, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, they're killing coral reefs, they are wiping out amphibians, they are putting docks in every mother's breast milk, they're changing the climate, they are putting dams on every river, they're polluting the air, they're doing all this stuff, they're killing life on this planet, we would know what to do. We would know to resist. Instead, nobody in their right mind would think, oh, if we buy special shampoo, it's going to stop the aliens. I mean, this is absurd. But we get really crazy. And one of the reasons we get so crazy with all this is because so many indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. We have to not identify with the system, but instead have your loyalty be with the salmon. Have your loyalty be with the fish in the oceans. Have your loyalty be with the land where you live. And suddenly things become very, very straightforward.
Well, here in the UK, we really have no wilderness left to save and no indigenous peoples to learn how to live on the land from. How do we try and restore a land base that has been extracted from, poisoned for a hundred of years, and here in London, bombed to hell? How can city folk develop a relationship with the natural world?
I'm just going to greatly defer mostly to Derek on this, but okay. I'll just say briefly that and Chernobyl has seen like a tremendous like regrowth of nature. This is an area that was like hugely irradiated because of the nuclear meltdown that happened there in the 80s. And just the fact that the human beings left the area alone for, you know, 30 plus years has basically shown us that what happens when we get the fuck out of nature's way, you know, nature will do its thing. So that's my brief answer, is that in places like England, the British should just leave nature alone in the areas where they can. I understand that it's an overpopulated country, that you can't just instantly depopulate the island, but there certainly has to be like areas that people can stop messing with, like all those golf courses and such, right? Mm-hmm. I'll just pass it on to Derek.
Yep, and maybe all those private lands, you know, the Queen owns quite a lot, actually. Maybe reclaiming some of that. Derek, yeah, over to you.
I completely agree. When one of the few things that gives me optimism these days is Chernobyl, you know, there's wolves, there's packs of wolves, there's lots of them, and there's birds they haven't seen in 100 years, and the beavers are destroying the canals, and it all makes me really happy. And one of the things that says to me is that the day-to-day workings of industrial civilization are worse than even the worst nuclear catastrophe, and that's really scary. Mm-hmm. I've heard that there are places in the UK that people have been kicked off of because they're so polluted, and that various insects are coming back who have not been seen there for a long time. And so really your question, I guess I'm just doing a longer version of saying the same thing that Frank did, which is why he made a fairly short film and I wrote 1,000 pages to say the same goddamn thing. He's much more succinct than I. I think that the land knows what it wants, and we can do work to help reforest. You know, the UK, sorry, what's the island actually called?
UK, United Kingdom?
No, that's the country, isn't it?
The United Kingdom is what you would say. That's like Wales, Ireland, and England together, the United Kingdom.
Okay, UK. Well, let's just say the whole big island.
Okay, yeah.
The whole island there was, a lot of it was heavily forested. And so I think work can be done to help reforest. And so far as how people can reconnect, even in a city, is I think one of the important things to do is to recognize that even in the city, there are still living beings. There are still, I don't know, maybe seagulls, and to recognize that they're living beings too, and to start there. And one reason I say this is because we need to recognize that we don't really deserve to see bears unless we treat the land well. And we don't deserve to see, I mean, that's one of the reasons I hate zoos, because they have the pretense that you can go in and you can see a wolverine without actually living such that a wolverine would want you to see them. And I think also when we think about London, did you know that there used to be hippos on the Thames?
Yeah, I was listening to your interviews today and yesterday, actually, before that you've done previously. And yeah, you said that. And elephants in China? No, where were the elephants? Maybe in China, were they? But yeah, hippos in England,
wow. There are elephants in China.
Yeah, that's right.
Obviously, they're not going to come back.
No, yeah, it's too late now, yeah.
Yeah, but that doesn't alter the fact that you can reforest. You can reforest, you can leave stuff alone. Yeah. And it'll come back.
Yeah, exactly. It can reforest, yeah.
Yeah. So leave it alone. And also, fight to stop people who are destroying it. That's the other thing that's really important.
Yeah, exactly, precisely. Otherwise, we're not going anywhere. My favourite part of the film is the Star Wars analogy that tears apart the passivity of passivism. Did either of you go through the transition from non-violent activism to a more direct militant approach? And or do you have a more understanding of that approach? And if so, why?
The Star Wars analogy were actually the very first words that I heard Derek say. And I have an abnormally loud laughter. Like, I'm the last person you want to go to the movies with, because I'll laugh. And I'll also probably laugh at the most inappropriate things. And I was just cracking up, just because I think that, Derek said that I made 1,000 pages of Endgame into an hour. There's two things that I had to say about that real quickly, is that I made the movie so that people will read Endgame, just because I think Endgame just sums it all up, and it certainly changed the way I prioritize my work. I actually, now all the work that I do is about pushing for this idea of bringing down civilization. But I think, like, in the end, like, Derek summed up his old books almost entirely in a sense with that Star Wars analogy, which, which is about 5 to 7 minutes. And I think that the ridiculousness of North American passivity, specifically to an enemy that's destroying everything that we need to live, is genius that you can use popular culture like Star Wars to actually show it, right? I think that if I would have made the movie maybe a year later, I would have done like the environmentalist version of Avatar, which is now like the most hugely successful movie out there. But I think that the powers that be have conditioned North Americans specifically to not have this fighting spirit. I mean, when I went on tour, when I started the NSIP tour in North America, I left probably a few days after the beginning of the Egyptian Revolution. And people will always tell me, well, what about Egypt? Egypt was a nonviolent revolution. And I would just say, holy shit, this just happened like 5 days ago. And then pacifism is already claiming victory for a revolution that used a diversity of tactics, when people attacked Mubarak's headquarters all over Egypt, set buildings on fire, fought the police, and essentially opened up the space for nonviolent protesters to actually take Tahrir Square. But this is basically the place that we're living in right now, which any time somebody raises their fist and decides to resist in a way that makes the liberal status quo uncomfortable, that it either gets blocked, like, our lefty news outlets don't celebrate those things, or they get denounced, or and here we are, basically at the precipice of the end of the world, and we're debating whether or not to, you know, setting a building on fire is violent or not.
To catch the full version of it, go to www.thecircledet.com.